Israel has the right, indeed it has the obligation, to defend itself against these attacks from Hamas. The way that Israel does this matters. It needs to do it in a way that affirms the shared values that we have for human life and human dignity, taking every possible precaution to avoid harming civilians.
Yes, please. Let's do that, shall we?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, it isn't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, up in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk. Not to mention most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Greatly appreciate you joining us today. I have pushed off our scheduled guest for today because, well, as usual today, there's quite a bit of news that I want to that we need to hit here, and more news, frankly, than I wish we had to cover. Unfortunately, once again, we start in the Middle East as Israel responds to the horrific and deadly surprise attack by Hamas now more than a week ago, and as humanitarian concerns increase amid Israel's retaliatory response against Gaza. With both attacks now including death tolls well over 1,000 on each side, and the toll in Gaza now rising by the hour, it seems, along with an increasingly dire humanitarian crisis and some confusion about whether food and water and medical supplies that were cut off by Israel to Gaza would now be allowed in to Gaza through the one access point in the south of the Gaza Strip from Egypt. Now, we focused last week several times on the show whenever President Biden had made public remarks in the wake of the attack. While reiterating U.S. support for Israel, he also, each time that he referenced his conversations with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, he reiterated the need to follow, quote, the rules of war, the rules of war. As if it seemed to underscore the U.S. concern about the proportionality of the Israeli response to the attack and what we have now seen as the death and suffering or otherwise of innocent Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip, including many women and children. Other administration officials over the weekend were a bit more explicit about some of those concerns, as was the president himself during an interview on 60 Minutes on Sunday. As the Washington Post reported last night, Biden administration officials signaled Sunday that they were trying to mitigate the humanitarian consequences of an expected Israeli ground invasion of the Gaza Strip, even as the Palestinian death toll from airstrikes continued to rise and aid earmarked for the enclave remained stuck in Egypt. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, during an appearance on CNN's State of the Union, said people in Gaza deserved, quote, access to water and medicine and food. And he said we are working actively to ensure that happens. Israel had agreed to turn on, quote, the water pipe, he said, but only to southern Gaza. Now, several days ago, Israel warned some 1 million residents of northern Gaza to evacuate to the southern part of the densely populated strip of land on the Mediterranean Sea within 24 hours, which brought objections from both the UN and human rights organizations, which all characterized such an unprecedented evacuation as impossible. President Biden, in an interview that aired Sunday on CBS 60 Minutes, told interviewer Scott Pelley that he thought an Israeli occupation of Gaza would be a, quote, big mistake, and he sought to draw a distinction between Hamas and ordinary Palestinians.
Would you support Israeli occupation of Gaza at this point?
I think it'd be a big mistake. Look, what happened in Gaza, in my view, is Hamas and the extreme elements of Hamas don't represent all the Palestinian people. And I think that it would be a mistake to for Israel to occupy Gaza again.
Do you believe that Hamas must be eliminated entirely?
Yes, I do.
You would like to see humanitarian supplies brought into Gaza?
Yes.
So you do not agree with the Israeli total siege of the Gaza Strip?
I'm confident that Israel is going to act under the rules of war. There's a standards that democratic institutions and countries go by. And so I'm confident that there's going to be an ability for the innocents in Gaza to be able to have access to medicine and food and water.
Now, there is unfortunately some confusion about that access today after officials over the weekend had suggested that the crossing into Egypt would be opened to allow supplies into Gaza and allow foreign nationals to cross out into Egypt when the border is opened to allow for humanitarian aid. That, according to a statement from a representative of the Palestinian embassy in Egypt on Sunday, hundreds of Palestinian American citizens are among those who have been unable to leave Gaza following Israel's punishing response to the Hamas attack and round-the-clock bombardment of Gaza via airstrikes. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Sunday that 8 days of Israeli strikes in Gaza had killed some 2,670 people, had wounded 9,600. The U.S. Has increased its own confirmed death toll of Americans since last week's siege in Israel, pegging the number of Americans killed now to be 30, with another 13 still missing. The number of hostages now believed held by Hamas has also increased. It was around 150 last week. That number is now nearly 200 held, potentially in the same areas that are now being bombarded by Israel. On Sunday, the State Department announced that it had designated David Satterfield, a seasoned diplomat, as a special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues. That's good. With a mandate to, quote, facilitate the provision of life-saving assistance to the most vulnerable people and promote the safety of civilians. That emphasis, according to the Washington Post, represented a shift for the Biden administration, which has given blanket support to Israel's military operations in advance of a ground invasion that human rights groups say will result in large-scale civilian casualties. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, after touching down in Egypt on Sunday, offered remarks on his days of shuttle diplomacy in the region in the recent days, with a focus on human rights for civilians caught in the crossfire, or at least as close to such a focus as we usually hear from American officials. Here are some of his remarks, at least until the live pool feed was actually cut off somehow midstream.
We are here at what is an extremely difficult and very tenuous time for the region in the wake of the slaughter perpetrated by Hamas. We came here with four key objectives: to make clear that the United States stands with Israel, to prevent the conflict from spreading to other places, to work on securing the release of hostages, including American citizens, and to address the humanitarian crisis that exists in Gaza. We started, as you know, in Israel, and it was important to make it very clear that the United States has Israel's back. We will stand with it today, tomorrow, and every day. And we're doing that in word and also in deed. I spent time with Prime Minister Netanyahu to go through the needs that Israel may have to make sure it can effectively defend itself. And you've already seen a lot of that assistance moving forward, and that's a conversation that'll continue. Israel has the right, indeed it has the obligation, to defend itself against these attacks from Hamas and to try to do what it can to make sure that this never happens again. As I said in Tel Aviv, as President Biden has said, the way that Israel does this matters. Needs to do it in a way that affirms the shared values that we have for human life and human dignity, taking every possible precaution to avoid harming civilians. After we left Israel, we've gone now to, I think I've lost track, but to six countries in the region: Jordan, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, now here in Egypt. And the purpose of seeing all of our partners was first and foremost to listen to them, to hear how they're seeing this crisis, and to look at what we can do together to deal with many of the concerns that it's raised. What I've heard from virtually every partner was a determination, a shared view.
It looks like we have lost the feed to Antony Blinken there, who was speaking before departing Cairo.
Now, a transcript of Secretary Blinken's full remarks were posted to the State Department website, so I can fill in the rest of his comments before he then took a short Q&A with journalists. The transcript shows the Secretary of State saying there, where he was cut off, quote, "What I've heard from virtually every partner was a determination, a shared view that we have to do everything possible to make sure this doesn't spread to other places, a shared view to safeguard innocent lives, a shared view to get assistance to Palestinians in Gaza who need it, and we're working very much on that," the Secretary said. I made clear, he said, that it cannot be, must not be business as usual with Hamas going forward. And at the same time, I said we're determined to do everything we can to address the needs of people in Gaza. Civilians should not have to suffer for Hamas's atrocities, he said. "We are now very actively engaged with countries in the region, with the United Nations, with Israel, to make sure, to the best of our ability, that people can get out of harm's way and that the assistance they need, the food, water, medicine, can get in." Today, he added, the president appointed one of our most senior diplomats, one of our more experienced diplomats, Ambassador David Satterfield, to lead our humanitarian efforts. He mentioned the appointment of Satterfield said that he hopes that he will be helping to move assistance to people who need it and helping people get out of harm's way. But in fact, there was little sign on Sunday of any substantive steps toward easing the situation in Gaza, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared that Israeli soldiers were, quote, "ready to take action at any time in order to defeat the bloodthirsty monsters who have risen against us to destroy us." Meanwhile, the siege has prevented food and fuel and electricity and water from getting to the enclave's more than 2 million residents. Nearly a million people have been displaced in the space of a week, according to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Gaza was running out of food and clean water, forcing people to use, according to the agency, dirty water from wells, increasing the risks of waterborne diseases. Relief supplies, according to the Post, have been sitting at an airport in Egypt, less than an hour's drive from the border with Gaza. Some of the aid supplies delivered by regional countries like Turkey, as well as the United Nations, have been stranded on the Egyptian side of the border now for days. The Post reports that one of the main obstacles to the delivery of that aid is the Israeli government's refusal to guarantee that it will not bomb relief trucks. Having trouble getting an agreement from Israel to not bomb relief trucks. Humanitarian groups said they are desperate to see that aid start moving. Egypt's representative for UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, said on Sunday, quote, "We are calling on all parties to open the humanitarian corridor, to have a humanitarian pause in the conflict, and to open the border to allow supplies to go in to children who need them right now." Plane loads of aid from the UN had arrived on the Egyptian side of the border with Gaza. And that includes drinking water, hygiene kits, portable toilets. A spokesperson for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said, quote, "We don't know when it's coming. It needed to come 8 days ago." Staffers at the agency who had relocated to southern Gaza were rationing water, she said. 500,000 Palestinians were sheltering at the organization's facilities under increasingly desperate conditions. Blinken, Secretary Blinken, in an interview with Al Arabiya, also said that water was turned back on for Gaza, but much of Gaza's water comes from pumping stations and desalination plants, which cannot operate without electricity or fuel for generators. And those desalination plants use a lot of energy, a lot of electricity, Desi Doyen.
Yes, they do. So, you know, hey, great that you say that you're letting the water back in, but if you're not allowing electricity or fuel to be delivered to the only electric power plant in the Gaza Strip, which runs on diesel fuel, which has run out of diesel fuel, so they have to allow deliveries of fuel to that plant to turn the water back on, because that's what's required to turn the electricity back on to pump the water.
Other diplomats were less optimistic than the Biden administration that progress was being made on the humanitarian front. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in a late afternoon statement, he said that, quote, "Gaza is running out of water, electricity, and other essential supplies, even as aid stockpiled in Egypt and in Jordan and in the West Bank and Israel itself could be, quote, dispatched within hours." He added, "We are on the verge of the abyss in the Middle East, and neither the hostages being held by Hamas nor humanitarian aid to Gaza, quote, should become bargaining chips." Fadi Abu Shamala is the executive director of the General Union of Cultural Centers in Gaza. He wrote from the Khan Yunis refugee camp in Gaza in a letter that was published by the New York Times. Shamala wrote, "The bombs exploded a few hundred feet from where I was sitting with my wife, Safa, and my three children, Ali, Karam, and Adam. Ali, 13 years old, screamed. Karam, 10, buried his face in my chest, and Adam, 5, burst into tears. We were in the outdoor area at the Rafah crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt on Tuesday morning. I had been lucky enough to obtain permits for my wife and kids to cross into Egypt so they could wait out the terrifying violence raining down on Gaza in safety. But before their names were called, Israel bombed the crossing. At that point, the only way in or out of the strip. The crossing was being closed. We jumped in my car and sped back to my family home in the Khan Yunis refugee camp, where Ali and Adam continued to cry while Karam sat silently shaking. We were just one family experiencing one terrifying close call. More than 2 million Palestinians are trapped inside of Gaza, about half under the age of 18, as Israel pounds us in retaliation for Hamas's surprise attack on Saturday. Apartment complexes in Gaza City have been leveled, houses bombed, and families annihilated. At least 326 children in the Gaza Strip have been killed since Saturday,
according to the Ministry of Health here. Women and children from my extended family were killed in an attack on Tuesday, and my cousin was killed on Wednesday. Yoav Gallant, Israel's Minister of Defense, called us, quote, human animals, and announced that the suffocating siege that Palestinians in Gaza have endured for more than 15 years would be tightened even further. No electricity means raw sewage is seeping into Gaza's streets. Waste treatment facilities require electricity. The water supply has been cut. Dread grows inside me as I know the worst is yet to come. Over 2,300 Israelis and Palestinians have been killed so far, he writes, the majority of them civilians. I'm saddened by the killing of all civilians. I know that the pain of an Israeli parent is no different from the anguish of a mother or a father in Gaza. Yet I am not surprised that we have found ourselves at this bloody point of no return. Many of the fighters, writes Shamala, who breached those walls are probably just a few years older than Ali, his son. Many of them were born during the Second Intifada. Their entire experience has been Israeli military occupation, siege, and devastating military assault upon assault in an enclave of 140 square miles, with unemployment and poverty rates of approximately 50%. This is the history, and these are the conditions that have shaped so many in Gaza, not a justification. I'm trying to imagine some positive outcome that this terrifying escalation might bring. He writes, I have always preferred unarmed, civilian-led, direct mass action. Maybe the Palestinian, Israeli, and international activists who have been using these tactics to oppose Israel's occupation and a system that major human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Israeli rights group, B'Tselem, opposed to what is considered apartheid, will be able to harness this horror to someday advance their vision of a future of liberation and a decent life for all. But at the moment, with Israeli troops massing on the border with Gaza, suggesting an imminent ground invasion, I can't think beyond the coming days. How many more families will be obliterated? How many children will be made orphans and homeless? What will become of our collective humanity if Israeli civilians continue to be targeted and bombs keep shattering our infrastructure, leaving Gazan children lying dead in our streets? Without outside pressure, particularly from the United States, Israel can continue to flatten our cities and refugee camps. As Israel maintains its rampage, I keep asking myself, he says, what's in store for Ali and Karam and Adam? We are unable to shield them from the pervasive violence and trauma. Ali is a talented young musician with an artist's temperament and a musician's soul. Does Israel want to convert him from an artist to a fighter? If my children have no hope for their future, I cannot guarantee what path they take. The international community must immediately do everything in its power to ensure that my children, that all children in the region, are able to live in freedom, with dignity and safety. That is the only solution to the current horror show, writes Fadi Abu Shamala from Gaza. Now, MSNBC was able to receive an audio statement from Shamala, the author of that letter, published by the New York Times last week. Shamala spoke again about the surging humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Thousands of Palestinians from Gaza City and north of Gaza City are evacuating their homes. It's horrible. There's no taxes for these large numbers. It's been the morning and the noon and the afternoon. I'm helping lots of friends for securing homes. There's not enough homes here in the south of Gaza Strip. We are talking about 1.1 million of displaced people. This is the expected number. Not the majority of the people of the north and Gaza City are not evacuating yet. There's no fuel. I'm running out of my car fuel. It's horrible. People, there's no much enough food. There's no much enough bread. It's horrible. Gaza will never die. We'll keep alive. Thank you so much.
Gaza will never die. We'll keep alive. Thank you so much, he said at the end there. So that is, by and large, where we are at this moment in Israel and Gaza. We will, of course, keep our eye on the situation as it continues to develop and or devolve. But the situation has inflamed tensions here at home as well, of course, and now with deadly results, thanks in no small part, by the way, to right-wing media. Mourners gathered in a Chicago suburb on Monday for the funeral of a 6-year-old Muslim boy who was stabbed to death over the weekend by a man who police say targeted him and his mother because they were Palestinian Americans. Services for the boy, identified as Wadea al-Fayoum, took place at the Mosque Foundation in Bridgeview, Illinois, a community southwest of Chicago known as Little Palestine for its heavy concentration of Palestinian Americans. Police said the 6-year-old boy and his 32-year-old mother were attacked by their landlord on Saturday in Plainfield Township, about 40 miles southwest of Chicago. The boy, a 6-year-old boy, was stabbed 26 times by the man, while his mother was stabbed more than a dozen times. Incredibly, she was expected to survive. Detectives were able to determine that both victims in this brutal attack were targeted by the suspect due to them being Muslim, according to the Will County Sheriff's Office in a news release. In the petition requesting that the landlord be detained, Assistant State's Attorney Michael Fitzgerald said that right before the attack, the landlord confronted the boy's mother and, quote, told her he was angry at her for what was going on in Israel. Shaheen stated that she responded to him by saying, let's pray for peace. And then he attacked her with a knife. The suspected assailant's wife told investigators that he, quote, listens to conservative talk radio on a regular basis and became obsessed with the war between Hamas and Israel. He was reportedly screaming, quote, you Muslims have to die, when he barged into the ground floor apartment the mother and son shared in the suburban Plainfield town of Plainfield after migrating from Palestine for a better life in the U.S. The man also shouted, according to a family friend, you are killing our kids in Israel. You Palestinians don't deserve to live. It is a worst nightmare come true. It is something we tried to warn against, said Ahmed Rehab, the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, on Monday.
This individual, there are claims that he is of a Jewish background and he was incensed by what happened in Israel and has been watching the news. This person did not have a track record with a family. As a matter of fact, the father says that he had built a treehouse for the boy and allowed him to swim in a makeshift pool and brought him toys. But it wasn't until he started watching the news and hearing the statements that something changed. And that's why the family had no reason to suspect what was to occur. I ask you, what level of hate, blind hatred, can cause such an act? This atmosphere has created a monster out of a normal man who once built a treehouse.
It has indeed. The boy who was stabbed 26 times just celebrated his 6th birthday 2 weeks ago. Before the stabbings, there were no known issues or conflicts with this 71-year-old landlord, the family said. Attorney General Merrick Garland late on Sunday said the U.S. Justice Department would open a federal hate crime investigation into the attack. Quote, this incident cannot help but further raise the fears of Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian communities in our country with regard to hate-fueled violence, a statement said from the Justice Department. In Dearborn, Michigan, with one of the largest concentrations of Muslim people in the nation, a man was charged over the weekend with making a social media post that threatened violence against Palestinian American residents, according to the police. So, yes, that's where we are. I've got much more today. Human rights concerns in our own country, some elections and democracy, both here in the U.S. and around the world. But let me take a quick break here, and we'll come back with some of that. Unless you would like to call in at 818-985-5735 with thoughts on any or all of the above, if you're in our live listening area in Southern California, or if you're listening via our worldwide web stream at kpfk.org. And as I asked last week, when I opened the phone lines, I had asked for callers, listeners, to do your best to not inflame an already obviously inflammatory moment if possible. That's the business model, frankly, for right-wing talk radio. That is the business model that led to that just horrific killing near Chicago over the weekend of that six-year-old boy. Let's not do that. And I realize it may or may not be possible at this point, given the circumstances, to even discuss this without inflaming to a certain extent. I certainly don't mean to in what I'm doing here. I'm trying to let you know what is happening. I am trying to inform, not inflame, albeit amid certainly inflammatory circumstances here. But we had a number of excellent callers, I thought, last week from all sides of the aisle who were, in fact, able to do that. And if time allows and I'm able to get to some of those calls, it would be nice if we could try and do that again today. 818-985-KPFK is our phone number. You'll need to hit button number one to join us on air. We are in Fun Drive again here this week at KPFK, our flagship affiliate station here in Los Angeles. So you can call that same number and hit button number two to donate to help keep us on the air. Or you can stop by kpfk.org to donate at any time there if you are listening via the podcast or somewhere else. Let them know, please, that you're a broadcast listener. Also, if you are listening via another station, please consider supporting them as well, as almost all of our affiliates are struggling to stay on your public airwaves. Right-wing media has no such problem. They are backed by corporations and all sorts of haters who are happy to pay for that crap. Meanwhile, those of us trying to tell the truth, as difficult as it is on some days, are struggling to stay on the air, and we can't do it without your help. So our phone number, 818-985-KPFK. Let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with more Bradcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hi, this is Desi Doyen from the Green News Report and the Bradcast. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We will get to your calls momentarily, I hope, at 818-985-5735. Hit button number one to join us on the air, whether I can get to. There were some elections in Louisiana and around the globe over the weekend. As I note, that may have to be put off till, till maybe tomorrow. I want to do very quickly hit on the, since we're talking about human rights in the first segment there, I want to talk about some concerns about human rights here at home regarding the humanitarian and civil rights record of the U.S. in recent years. As AP reports today, a settlement filed Monday in a long-running lawsuit over the Trump administration's separation of parents and their children at our own southern border will bar the government from similar separations for 8 years, for the next 8 years, while also providing benefits like the ability for parents to come to America and work, according to the Biden administration on Monday. The settlement between the Biden administration and the ACLU, which has been representing families separated from their children, still has to be approved by the judge in this case, but if finalized, it would make it much more difficult for any administration, including former President Donald Trump, the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination, to revive one of his most controversial and horrific tactics to try and halt immigration at the southern border if he should win next year's election. So this settlement is good news. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas told the AP, quote, "It is our intent to do whatever we can to make sure that the cruelty of the past is not repeated in the future." The Trump administration, as you will recall, separated thousands of children from their parents or guardians that they were traveling with as it moved to criminally prosecute people for crossing the southwestern border. Minors cannot be held in criminal custody with their parents, and so they were transferred eventually to the Department of Health and Human Services and then typically sent to live with a sponsor, often a relative or someone else with family connections. But a faulty tracking system by U.S. officials in the Trump administration, whether it was faulty on purpose or not is a separate question, but it caused many to be apart for an extended time or horrifically, never reunited with their parents. Trump eventually reversed course on that policy in 2018 in the wake of opposition, just days before a judge put a halt to the practice anyway after a lawsuit brought by the ACLU. But during a CNN town hall earlier this year, Trump did not rule out once again separating families if he were to win re-election. In fact, he seemed to be calling for reinstituting that unspeakably cruel policy. Lee Gallant, the lead counsel for the ACLU, praised the settlement on Monday. He noted, quote, "This settlement means that babies and toddlers will finally get to see their parents after years apart, and that these suffering families will now have an opportunity to seek lawful status. It also crucially bars an attempt by a future administration to reenact another family separation policies," he said. "Nothing can make these families whole again, but this is at least a start." President Joe Biden issued an executive order on his first day in office to reunite families that had been separated in the previous administration. According to figures released by the Department of Homeland Security in February, 3,881 children were separated from their families from 2017 through 2021. About 74% of those have been reunited with their families. This settlement filed in federal court in San Diego does not include monetary damage, but it does provide key benefits, including authorization for parents of separated children to come to the U.S. under humanitarian parole for 3 years and work in the U.S. The families receive some help with housing and medical and behavioral health benefits designed to address some of the trauma associated with the separations that we caused. Mayorkas said, quote, "We need to help these families heal, and that is an obligation that we carry because of the pain that we inflicted upon them." Under the settlement, it would still be possible to separate children at the border from their parents or guardians, but only under limited scenarios, as had been the case for many years prior to the cruel Trump administration's bastardization of those rules. They include if the child is being abused or if the parent committed a much more serious crime than simply crossing the border. The settlement also requires the government to keep detailed documentation when it does separate children from parents, so as to avoid the chaos that erupted during the Trump-era family separations, where parents and children could not be reunited. Ever. 818-985-KPFK. Let's get to some of your calls. Let's go to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hey, GS, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you very much, Brad. Wow. Hello to you. Hello to Desi. Your show is one of my absolute favorites across the entire radio dial. I look forward to it every day.
Thank you, sir. Even on a grim day like today, my apologies for that.
Well, yeah, as if you had anything to do with what's going on. But still, you report it dispassionately as best you can. Although we can still feel, you know, what's a little bit of what must be going on in your own heart. I just want to thank you for doing what you do. And other than that, with regard to what's going on, the depths of depravity to which human beings can fall just is so appalling to me. It makes me wonder, you know, if I get to reincarnate, should I really want to come back as a human being again? Obviously, that's tongue-in-cheek, but it just, I don't know how we approach peace except by doing the kinds of things the Pacifica stations do, which is to address issues as close as we can as individuals to the truth. You know, let's listen to the facts. Let's figure out what's really going on. And, you know, there's much more to be done, politics and all the rest of it, but the only way people are ever going to find peace is if they talk with one another. And I personally recommend, I'll finish with this, I personally recommend meet with people you disagree with and get together over food. Lunch or dinner, serve them together, serve one another in your own homes perhaps, or just go out to dinner or something, but discuss things in a dispassionate and polite way. Other than, I don't know what else I know how to do. That's what works best for me, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you for what you do.
Well, GS, let me just say, I really appreciate that. I appreciate that thought, and reading that story about the six-year-old in Chicago who had gotten along, apparently the family had gotten along with this guy for a long time, but something just snapped within him. And I think we've seen that from a lot of folks. I hope to talk actually in the coming days on this program with a guy who is an avowed, now reformed MAGA guy to sort of explain the thinking of someone who joins that cult in the first place. And then interestingly, how he got out of it. So I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. But I think talking about difficult subjects, look, there is no more difficult subject than Israel-Palestine, obviously. But if it was only Israel-Palestine that we were having trouble communicating on, we'd be okay. It is everything that we can't seem to have discussions about with people who may or may not agree with us anymore. The country has been broken. Donald Trump broke it. And if you look at the U.S. House, they can't even elect a Speaker of the House. Republicans can't even agree with Republicans to do the right thing. So it's madness. And GS, I really appreciate your vote of support here for what we try to do every day.
Keep up the great work. Thanks a million.
Thank you, brother. 818-985-KPFK is our phone number. 818-985-5735. Let me get to Marwan here. Marwan in Orange County. Hey, welcome back to the broadcast. I think you called in a week or so ago, sir.
Yes, Brad. Thank you for having me. Yes, I called last week, and I was hoping things will get better. But apparently we're going the wrong direction. And I think, and I mentioned this last time, I think the only solution is the one-state solution, right for all, for everyone, regardless of your religion. But one thing I want to mention, what's happening right now in the United States and in the Western media and the Western countries, it's really crazy. I mean, the media is biased. Again, I don't condone any violence. Mm-hmm. But the media is very biased. and they're not. And you just heard about this kid, 6 years old, who got killed, stabbed 26 times.
Yeah.
The landlord that he knew the family, and look what the media is doing. This is just unbelievable. And I think we should hold the media and hold also the administration, including Biden, responsible for this massacre. And let's call it the way it is a genocide.
Let me ask you, we should hold Joe Biden accountable for what happened in Chicago? How so?
Yes, exactly.
How so?
I personally voted for Biden. I would not. And I think Biden and the administration, I mean, everybody who supported this on both sides, and the Democrat and Republican, and you can disagree with me, but that's okay.
Well, no, I'm not trying to disagree with you, Marwan. I'm trying to understand, how is Joe Biden responsible for what happened in Chicago? And the reason I'm asking is because I just spent quite a bit of time in the first block of this show going through what the U.S. Administration is doing, really for the first time in my memory. Speaking up for Palestine, speaking up for those who are, in this humanitarian crisis in Gaza. I have not heard an administration speak like that. Now, whether they're successful or not, whether they're doing enough, one of the reasons I'm also talking about it is because I wish to hold their feet to the fire. But to say that Joe Biden or the Biden administration is somehow responsible, Lord knows, for what happened in Chicago, you're going to have to explain that one to me, Marwan.
I don't want to get in. I don't think we have enough time on this. It's just
You had enough time, sure, to say he was responsible for a six-year-old being stabbed 26 times. So I think you have the responsibility here, Marwan.
I won't say directly. I say indirectly. He's responsible. Yes, he is.
Why?
Because he's not putting a stop to this genocide. Okay. He's also resenting taking a one side. Okay, and dehumanizing the Palestinian, and the Palestinians are just fighting for their rights. Okay. If we can sit here and discuss why. I mean, just watch his administration. Watch his. How are they taking the Israel? You just showed it on your show just a minute ago. The person who was talking about the Palestinian and how are they're just dehumanizing Palestinian. That we don't. I just was watching the news. Three generation was wiped out in one bomb. Three generation.
Right, and that's why I'm trying to both encourage the Biden administration to do more along the lines and laud them for when they do the right thing. I challenge you to find any administration in U.S. History who has spoken out about the humanitarian crisis of the Palestinian people the way we are seeing it now. Is it perfect? Are they getting it all right? Absolutely not. But if we're just going to, say a blanket criticism of any U.S. administration, we're not going to get anywhere, Marwan.
I'll be happy to send you examples offline. But one thing I want to say, last election, Biden won by very, very narrow, and the Muslim and the Arab community helped him win.
Yep.
The election,
mm-hmm.
in a way, okay?
Yeah.
I don't think this is going to happen this time.
Okay.
I think a lot of people will not vote for Biden for simply not being an honest, a mediator, or maybe just taking the Israeli side and feeding the Palestinian. No, I'm not talking about Hamas. I'm talking about the Palestinian people as really their people. I mean, their life doesn't matter.
All right. Well, we will.
Just one more thing. Yep. One more thing before we.
Very
I
quickly.
Just one thing I don't understand. What's the Israeli strategy? To kill all Palestinians, or to really bring them to their knee to surrender so they can actually move on with their life as they. That's not going to happen. Even if you eliminate completely Hamas, some another group will come up.
Marwan, I gotta keep moving here.
Thank you so much.
Let me just say, Marwan, on that, I might agree with you. I would agree with you because I don't think they have a strategy that makes sense. I believe they're just sort of replaying the strategy now with more firepower that they've been playing for the last 40, 50 years, and it hasn't worked in those 40, 50, 60 years. I don't think it's going to work now. So we could agree on that, but let's just not make up stuff and assign.
I'm hoping Biden administration will quickly correct, they kind of really be a true mediator between this. Otherwise, there's no way on earth he's going to win again.
Thanks.
And I'm telling you that because a lot of that community not happy about that.
Thank you for the call, Marwin. Always good to hear from you, sir. 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to Spencer in Hermosa Beach. Hey, Spencer, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, how's it going?
You tell me.
I just wanted to make the point, and then kind of what the last caller was saying too. But you had CNN, the reporter Sarah Sidner, who confirmed the beheaded baby story twice on air, and then that story later was retracted, right? And then 2 days later, I'm listening to right wing, like a KFI media, and they're still parroting the same beheaded baby story after it's been retracted. So, and then on the last caller's point, you had President Biden make a public statement announcement saying that he had confirmed seeing photos that he didn't see. So, it's both sides of it. And then when the story gets retracted like that after CNN has run it, and then 2 days later you hear the right-wing media still pumping it out.
Well, of course, that's what they do. They look for those sorts of things, which is why it's so important, by the way, that we track down that story of these beheaded babies and make sure it's accurate. And I have to say, Spencer, I'm going to give more credence to that story. The claim was that there was 40 babies who had been beheaded. I'm going to give more credence to that claim, I think, than you might, if because I looked pretty deeply in it. There's a good explainer at Snopes.com on this. It doesn't appear well. It's confusing. There's very little firsthand confirmation of any of it. But it's not clear. It's not clear that it didn't happen. It's also not clear that, automatic machine gun fire can tear apart a baby, unfortunately, and result in a beheading that is not quite the ISIS-style beheading that it has been characterized as. So,
Just want to make the point, you hear all the Palestinians being killed, right? You hear the number go up, but how many Hamas fighters have they killed? I haven't heard one. Oh, we've got this many Hamas fighters. So it kind of sounds strange.
Thank you, Spencer. I appreciate that call. 818-985-KPFK. We're almost at the top of the hour here, aren't we? Let me go to Sophia in Montclair. Welcome to the broadcast, Sophia.
Hi, how are you? I just had a quick follow-up to Marwan's comment. You had said that you're hard-pressed to find another administration that has spoken out on behalf of the Palestinians. I think whatever the Biden administration has said, and yes, they have made a few comments of the need for restraint against this genocide, that is something that maybe 3-4 administrations ago we could have done, when they were encroaching upon their land settlement after settlement. Now there's a genocide going on. So that comment, that's a low bar.
Yes.
You've done more than anybody else.
Well, I agree.
In the face of a genocide, that is woefully inadequate. So, no.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I wouldn't necessarily say he pulled a gun to the 6-year-old kid's head, but I understand where Marwan is coming from.
Well, listen. If you wanted to talk about what they have or haven't done in Israel, have or haven't done enough of, okay. But he specifically said he blames what happened in Chicago on Joe Biden.
He's the guy in charge. He leads the tone of the nation.
Well, the tone of the nation is not encouraging people to go out and stab 6-year-olds. It's just not.
The tone of the nation is continuing a polarizing, one-sided point of view of the Israel-Palestine conflict in the small sense and the Muslim world conflict in the larger sense. So, yeah, I understand where Marwan is coming from. That is maybe a bit hyperbolic, what you said.
Yeah, yeah.
But
just
not too
a little.
Far off the mark, because the president holds, his tone has definitely led us down the path that we're going.
There's a lot of stuff I'll be happy to blame Joe Biden for. Killing a six-year-old kid in Chicago, unfortunately, is not one of them. But I hear you, and I really do appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we have got to – oh, do I have – I got to learn how to work these phones one of these days. Very quickly, let me get out. We're at the top of the hour here, but not without a visit from Morris in Long Beach. Hey, Mo, how are you holding up, my friend?
Hey, Bradley, remember when they were separating them kids down at the border?
Yep.
And a whole lot of faith guys went down there to say something?
Yep.
Well, the rabbis got arrested, Bradley. The rabbis went to jail. They didn't go down there for no political theater. So you ain't going to blame all of them. That's a fact. Take it easy, Bradley.
Thank you, Morris. Great to hear from you, as always. My apologies, I couldn't get to everyone else today. I know a lot of folks wanted to get through, but we've got a lot to get to. And I put a lot of it off until tomorrow. Maybe it'll be interesting still tomorrow. I think it will be. I hope you'll join me for it when I do. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.